All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. I want to welcome everybody here. It's an honor and a privilege to be able to engage with you in this panel presentation. This is a co-sponsored event. The co-sponsors are the Institute for Experiential Therapies, which is affiliated with the Masters of Arts in Counseling program here, and the Harrisonburg Center for Psychoanalysis. My name is Dr. Nate Kozer. I am a practicing psychoanalyst. I'm also a member of the faculty at the Masters in Counseling program and the founder of the Harrisonburg Center of Psychoanalysis as well. So just a brief note about how we plan to proceed tonight. We're going to read our papers straight through and then do question and answer at the end. So we've given you note cards and pens. Please note down any questions you have, because we really do want to hear them and engage you on whatever stands out. Because we're going to be reading straight through, please don't hesitate to come and go as you need to. Out these doors and to the left, I believe, restrooms and drinking fountains can be found. So each of my colleagues here will introduce themselves when they begin to read their paper. What we plan to do is go till 8:30, and that also includes the time for question and answer. If it gets really lively in here and there are more questions and people want to engage with us more, we can do so, but we have to kind of vacate the space at around that time. So without further ado, Michael.
Thanks, Nate.
Yeah.
My name is Michael Horst, and I'm a doctoral student at James Madison University in Counselor Education and Supervision. I also co-teach one course here in the Masters in Counseling Department. We've been doing our reading group for about a year and a half, and it's been going pretty well so far. And so this is sort of the culmination of where we've been. My paper tonight is going to focus on interpretation and psychoanalysis with particular emphasis on Nietzsche and what Nietzsche might have to offer to interpretation in the clinic for counselors and other members of the allied mental health professions, as well as psychoanalysis and maybe even art or literature, music, whatever. So let's get started. Two men, one religious and one not so much, are having a conversation about a terrible flood that devastated their community. The less religiously inclined man is sharing about how, as the floodwaters rose so quickly, he had no choice but to evacuate to his roof. In fear for his life, as his home became submerged more and more quickly in the floodwaters, he prayed to God, "Please save me from this flood. I will do anything if you get me out of this." As his doom became more and more imminent, a rescue team came along and saved him from his rooftop refuge. "Well, certainly now you believe," responds the religious man upon hearing such a story. "Oh no, that wasn't anything but good timing on the part of the rescue teams," replies the not-so-religious man. So you've probably heard some variation on this little parable. If, like me, you heard it in Sunday school, the ending was likely different and probably attempted to illustrate age-appropriate developmental conceptions of how God might work in the world. That's not the point here. Nor is the point of the story which person has the most correct interpretation of events and their meaning. Nor is the story here about how many other interpretive viewpoints could be introduced if more interlocutors were invited to join the conversation. The primary point of introducing the story now is briefly to illustrate how interpretation has a sort of looking back nature. The accuracy, truth value, effectiveness of an interpretation is not known until after the effect of the interpretation is experienced. This is to say that if the rescued man were to have interpreted his rescuers as divinely dispatched, then his experience of being rescued and now his understanding of most experiences would shift. Likewise for the religious man. So I would put forth that this too is the aim of interpretation not only in psychoanalysis, but also in arts, literature, and music. That questions that only assess the objective truth value, the concrete definitional meaning of a piece of art, the correct interpretation of a dream, can at worst miss the point and at best be incomplete. Complete interpretation requires an experience. An interpretation and the act of interpreting have an experiential effect. Interpretation is a reagent for change. So for help with this point, I'll turn to Nietzsche and The Birth of Tragedy. Of the many gifts bequeathed through furious aphorism by the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, the cultural and, I argue, phenomenological and epistemological distinction between what is Apollonian and what is Dionysian tops the list. The words themselves are gifts, as pleasurable to say and as regally beautiful to hear as the godly concepts they signify. And as David Foster Wallace would remind us, words are themselves things beyond their significations. But with that in mind, and understanding that the Nietzschean, Apollonian, Dionysian distinction may be clear for many already, I would like to illustrate the distinction as I see it from my interpretation. So a little primer on Greek mythology. Apollo is the god of the sun, and he embodies all of the certainty and clarity of the sun through reason, logic, and patient deliberation. What is objectively true with a capital T is Apollo's paramount aim. It's all about reason, calm, wisdom, and logical thinking. Dionysus, on the other hand, aims a little off-center. Missing the bullseye may actually be a bullseye for Dionysus. This is to say that Dionysus is, in short, the god of wine. He involves runaway passion, madness, and chaos. So for Nietzsche, the opposition between Apollo and Dionysus ran straight through Greek culture and bringing it home through all of us individually. For each person is a mix of Apollonian and Dionysian, part logical, reason-loving human, part frenzied, impulsive, dancing beast. At their finest, the Greeks made room for the tussle between Apollo and Dionysus. Where the Greeks went wrong for Nietzsche was in their eventual over-identification with Apollo. Following Socrates, the Greeks began to fetishize the Apollonian. They fell in love with the idea that they could understand themselves and the world and be totally wise, fully rational, logical beings. To this aim, they suppressed all that could be considered Dionysian. So why is this dangerous? Nietzsche argues that the actual wisdom that we can experience results from an integration of Dionysian and Apollonian ideals, that there's a part of us that implements calm, rational, reasonable approaches to understanding, and a part that is drawn to darkness, chaos, and madness. To take it further, to become too Apollonian may be to explain away the nature of an experience, and as collateral damage, also remove reagents for change or growth. On the flip side, to be too Dionysian is reckless and may bring more trauma than growth. I think that what Nietzsche argues is that there's a sort of sweet spot between the Apollonian and Dionysian in which a person must operate in the world. Forgetting one or the other is to cheat ourselves or worse. Another way to consider the Apollonian and Dionysian distinction may be in the true and the beautiful. The searing reason and insight brought by Apollo demands truth, explanation through logical use of reason. The dance done by Dionysus demands the appreciation of beauty and inspires awe at the ineffable, that which fails symbolization. These two are not at odds until one attempts to invalidate the other through over-identification within a person, theory, or culture. Repression of either reaps neurosis. A popular example may be a person who is colloquially anal, repressing the Dionysian and over-identifying with the Apollonian. Or on a larger scale, a culture with an unconscious ideology of hedonism becoming anti-intellectual and repressing the Apollonian. Hashtag YOLO. What I'm trying to say is that there is, in most things, a necessity for the integration of the Apollonian and the Dionysian. This is especially true for interpretation. The man rescued from his rooftop as the floodwaters rose may interpret from the Apollonian tact, evidence and facts only, and dismiss any further presumption or the power of the experience. On the other hand, of what is ultimately a false dichotomy, we can imagine a Dionysian person marveling in the miracle of the rescue, so captivated by the experience that she or he may seem delusional. Chances are most persons are somewhere in the middle, integrating the two. But here again, interpretation has a looking back nature. Full interpretation requires both insight and experience. Interpretation that is not merely an explanation or a translation. An interpretation is correct, Apollonian, to the extent that it affects you, Dionysian. This is the sort of interpretation that is a reagent for growth, a reagent for change. So shifting a little bit and talking about the clinic, the aim of psychotherapies of all sorts is to be a reagent for change or growth. Likewise, the aim of someone coming to therapy is likely some sort of change or growth. The question before most theories in psychotherapy is how? Within the therapeutic relationship, the therapist must open a space that allows for the free speech of the client or an alisand, someone who's in psychoanalysis, to explore their sense of being in the world. One way this gets tricky is that the explicit demands of the client may not align with the client's desire, and the action or non-action of the therapist interprets the demand.
either through meeting the explicit rational demand by Apollonian means, see here most cognitive and behavioral therapies, or through opening a space for something more, for an exploration or excitation of desire. The sort of Apollonian interpretation that responds to demands with explanations seem rational, well-meaning, and polite, but they often have very little effect. Bruce Fink elaborated on this by saying that interpretations are not all the same. What I'm conceptualizing as Apollonian interpretation can squelch desire if it works to satisfy a demand, rather than also working in a Dionysian way to open desire and set the unconscious in motion. Fink unpacked this eloquently. He explains that most common forms of interpretation in psychotherapy can be characterized as follows. The therapist tells the patient, in no uncertain terms, what the therapist thinks the meaning of the thought, dream, fantasy, or symptom to be. And he continued that certain therapists wait until the patient is very close to arriving at the same interpretation, thereby ensuring that the patient understands the interpretation more or less immediately. Nevertheless, the therapist, as listener or other, generally provides a very specific meaning, communicating to the patient that this is the true meaning. This sort of interpretation meets the explicit demand of the client by delivering a clear Apollonian meaning that can be understood in the light of the sun, experienced by the client and validated by the therapist. The trap springs because here again Dionysus is ignored. As reassuring as it may be to hold on to one clear meaning or association, doing so stands in the way of other possible associations. Further, this sort of interpreting, while seemingly satisfying at first, is eventually met with a yeah, yeah response from the client. Interpreting in this way meets a demand from the ego and does not stir anything up. This is why interpretation for Freud is less about what is correct or incorrect and more about what's productive and unproductive. What is productive interpretation is an interpretation that jolts the unconscious, that hits the real, interpretation that is perhaps a bit more Dionysian. The simplest way described by Fink is that an interpretation, rather than tying down one particular meaning, should suggest numerous meanings. So how's that done? A therapist may be a bit more Dionysian, a bit chaotic, by replying to the client's statements or demands for interpretation with interpretations that are vague, paradoxical, or enigmatic and polyvalent. This sort of interpreting stirs things up, consciously and unconsciously, for the client or analysand, by setting the client or analysand to task, trying to figure out what the therapist meant on an ego-to-ego level. Further, Fink writes that such interpretations resonate. They put the unconscious to work. Conscious thought processes, abhorring ambiguity and multiple meanings, committed as they are to the belief that there must always be one true meaning, sounding kind of Apollonian, are soon frustrated and cease. The unconscious, however, is set in motion, and the enigmatic words spoken by the analyst find their way into dreams and fantasies produced thereafter. Rational thinking gives way to the associative processes of the unconscious desire. This sort of oracular speech, think Oracle or Oracle at Delphi, contrasted with non-oracular speech, is frustrating for ego-to-ego communication, and clients or analysands may become irritated or impatient as a function of resistance. The client may feel that they cannot understand such statements at all. However, this is hopefully not the case. The therapist, being deliberately provocative, works to provide evocative interpretations that resonate, that put the unconscious to work and encourage the conscious mind to puzzle over the conundrum. This sort of interpretation, which I think some therapists may actually make by accident from time to time, may reemerge consciously for clients when clients share in another session, you know, I was thinking about what you said last time. And perhaps as a therapist you say, I don't remember saying that at all, but something you said resonated for them. After all, the other determines the meaning of our speech. I think this is evident in stand-up comedy. What a stand-up comedian says to a room full of people can be absolutely horrible, and they'll laugh. One of my favorite rotund comedians, Louis C.K., has a joke I like where he talks about how he envies people who stop eating when they're full. Do these people actually exist? Are there people that go, that's it for me, I'm full, I think I'll stop eating now. He says, the meal isn't over for me when I'm full, it's over when I hate myself. Well, and cue the laughter, because it is funny. When Louis delivers those lines, people can identify with a sentiment or find the self-deprecating humor funny. Regardless, the other, the listener, the audience, determines the meaning of the words. The words become a joke because the audience presumes the intent and laughs. Likewise, if Louis' exact words were spoken at an Overeaters Anonymous or Weight Watchers meeting, they would be met with sympathy and empathetic support rather than laughter. The other determines the meaning of speech. Most often, speakers and listeners work hard to ensure that what is spoken and what is heard are congruent in ego-to-ego communication. As Fink put it, we speak to express something to other people, but they determine what is meant. The listener's power is considerable. And this dynamic is placed under a microscope in the therapeutic relationship, and the analyst or therapist is tasked with the responsibility to function in a way that is evocative. Counselors do this too, through evocative responding and emotional heightening, depending on their theory and how they respond to conscious and unconscious listening maneuvers or relational patterns from the client. As with analysts, when counselors do not give the expected typical social response to the client, space is opened for something more. When what a person says is met with a polyvalent, oracular response rather than a typical expected response, the person must shift their ego to identify with what she or he interprets the interpretation to mean. Further, if the interpretation from the analyst resonated with the unconscious, the interpretation is even more productive. After all, the interpretations that have the greatest impact are often those that the person was not expecting. So, if explicit explanation of meaning, tying down one association and blocking others, or co-creating a narrative to form some postmodern truth, or meeting the simple demands of the client through cognitive behavioral problem solving, or healing through an empathic therapeutic relationship, or a corrective emotional experience is not the capital T truth in psychoanalysis, then what is? The truth is what has not yet been said. The truth is conceptualized for a person in terms of its relationship to the real. The real, for the client or analysand, is what has never been spoken or symbolized, or perhaps cannot be symbolized, that is, brought into speech. Interpretation that hits the real, which has truth value in psychoanalysis, brings into speech what had not previously been symbolized. Here, Nietzsche is helpful again in his discussion on perspectivism. Nietzsche's perspectivism is not relativism. Nietzsche doesn't deny that there couldn't be some big T truth out there, but if there were, we would not be in a position to confirm its veracity because our observations are biased and conceived of within a language, within a culture, within a perspective, and within the constraints of our expectations. Perspectivism, in a nutshell, means that every claim, belief, idea, or philosophy is tied to some perspective inherited from the other and sustained by the other. In an Apollonian sense, the world is signified, symbolized, and ordered in a rational, coherent way. It becomes impossible for us to detach ourselves from these lenses to perceive our lives objectively because we cannot separate from the other. What we can do is experience opposing perspectives. We can hit the real. To try to speak into an experience that was previously not symbolized, to touch the truth, we must hit the Lacanian real. The power of psychoanalysis is to have an impact on the real for the analysand, says Bruce Fink. Briefly, there's an ethic to this. Oscar Wilde reminds us that every portrait painted with feeling is a portrait of the artist, not of the person sitting for the portrait. Within the portrait, what becomes clearer, what is accentuated, where focus is drawn, are elements of the painter's perspective, not objective features, and much less are they elements of the sitter's experience. So this is too true of the too eager to help analyst, who rushes to offer well-meaning interpretations. Such interpretations are portraits of the analyst, not of the analysand. So another way to attempt understanding the position and work of the analyst is by comparing the analyst to the artist. To borrow again from Oscar Wilde, the moment you think you understand a great work of art, it's dead for you. The same could be said for the analysand. Once she or he thinks that she or he understand the interpretation, it dies. The analyst must provoke more, more from interpretation than simple explanation, and more in relationship than solidarity. The analyst works within and through the transference to continually open a space for more. Fink again reminds us that artists often let us look through the world through new eyes. He wrote that the painter reveals, or renders perceptible, something we had not seen before. In the case of Van Gogh, it might be the humanity in an old pair of shoes. In the case of Monet, it might be the shimmering colors in a garden under the influence of the hot sun. What is revealed through interpretation is not what was never there, but what was there and unseen, ignored, or too quiet to be noticed. Similarly, to borrow from the Icelandic artist Björk, there are certain emotions in your body that not even your best friend can sympathize with. But if you find the right film or the right book, it will understand you. This reversal, rather than the reader understanding the book understanding the reader, substitute song or painting, photograph, poem, what have you, is helpful in understanding the process of interpretation and analysis. Here again, the analyst is not explaining the truth of an interpretation to an eager-to-learn analysand. The analyst reflects words, statements, metaphors through oracular speech that incite, some homophony, interpretation. The interpretation is, in this way, The interpretation in this way understands the analysand rather than the other way around. So hitting the real bumps into the experience of the ineffable. Bringing into the symbolic that which hadn't previously been symbolized doesn't necessarily mean making clear what was murky. Eugene Genlin began his essay on how philosophy cannot appeal to experience and how it can by writing, "We can develop a new mode of language and thinking, which enters and speaks from what is more than conceptual patterns." Although these are always inseparably at work as well. For example, more than is a pattern, but here it says more than the pattern. What speaks to more than the pattern is of what is of interest in psychoanalytic interpretation. Psychoanalysis develops a new mode of language and thinking that undermines the traditional ego communication patterns and puts the unconscious to work. So, in conclusion here, I was reminded again of the way that interpretation permeates everyday speech when I was watching Peter Jackson's unfortunate adaptation of one of my favorite books, The Hobbit. In the beginning, Gandalf approaches Bilbo, who's sitting on his porch smoking his pipe and enjoying the morning. And Bilbo hasn't seen Gandalf since he was a young child, so he's rather perplexed when he sees a travel-worn, old, ragged wizard standing on his stoop staring at him. And he says politely, as any well-mannered hobbit would, "Good morning." To which Gandalf replies, "What do you mean? Do you mean to wish me a good morning? Or do you mean that it is a good morning whether I want it or not? Or perhaps you mean to say that you feel good on this particular morning? Or are you simply stating that this is a morning to be good on?" Bilbo, rather affronted at the breach in social protocol, responds, "All of them at once, I suppose." What's more interesting to me is that what Bilbo actually seems to be saying in "Good morning" is, "What the hell do you want?" Nothing Gandalf interprets is accurate, and I wager he knows it. Gandalf's interpretation does not need to be accurate in the Apollonian sense. Rather, it needs to have an effect. The effect Gandalf is going for is unsettling Bilbo enough that he can broach the topic of going on an adventure. And indeed, this invitation to adventurous Dionysian spirit completes interpretation beyond the insights gained through Apollonian explanation. Interpretation is born of our perspective and informs our perspective. It has a looking back nature. It hits the real and speaks the truth without saying it. Once it's said, it's dead. It's not the sense it makes, but the mark that's made. Because speaking brings the conversation alive, but it can also kill it. So the question before us with regard to interpretation is, how do we keep the conversation alive? In closing, I'll borrow from Bilbo again, 60 years after his great adventure, and say to each of you here tonight that I don't know half of you half as well as I would like, and I like less than half of you half as well as you deserve. I'll leave that up for your interpretation. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Michael. So my paper is titled "From Understanding to Conundrum on the Act of Interpretation." And I begin with two quotes from Lacan, the first from 1953, the second from 1972. The first, "But we learn that analysis consists in playing on the multiple staves of the score that speech constitutes in the registers of language, which is where overdetermination comes in, the latter having no meaning except in this order." The second, "What is at stake in analytic discourse is always this: to what is uttered as a signifier, you give another reading than what it means." So what is it to make an interpretation? What is required and what is necessary to do so? How are they accomplished? And most importantly, what are their effects? These questions take us to the quick because they concern the discourses in which many, if not all of us, find our place, discourse being a specific form of social bond. In a sense, to say discourse is always already to say interpretation. This is something we've learned over time because the signifier itself is opaque, its connection to the signified accidental, and the relation between structure and the real limited. There is always a remainder. Something inevitably slips away, leaving behind a not all. Yet an interpretation cannot be reduced to this common and potentially mundane relativism. As Lacan stated in Seminar 11, The Four Fundamental Concepts of Psychoanalysis, interpretation is not open to all meanings. In psychoanalysis, and perhaps other discourses as well, interpretation is something different, something precise. It is this difference to which I wish to direct my attention, not only to this difference, but also to the very act itself. I'll begin with a number of vignettes I've gathered to set the stage, as it were, because interpretation faces a second act problem. It was March 1961, and Atlantic Records had just released John Coltrane's seventh album. The title track, arguably one of the most recognizable pieces of jazz music in history, was My Favorite Things, and it does happen to be one of mine. As you know, My Favorite Things had originally been created for Rodgers and Hammerstein's The Sound of Music, a title that also plays on the signifier in interesting ways. But if you are a virgin to Coltrane, his is a version altogether unique, given his aversion for fixed styles and sounds. What you will hear is a beautiful, somewhat haunting, and alluring piece, with only slight references made to the melody of the original. They appear as if from nowhere, but each time they direct the listener's attention back to the kernel from which the piece had been formed. These fragments of a melody work as the foundation upon which a masterpiece is created. It was in the 1850s, throughout Ireland, a folk song emerged entitled Finnegan's Wake. This story of an Irishman fond of whiskey with a love for the liquor outlines the events of poor Finnegan's accidental death and his subsequent resurrection. After falling from a ladder and crushing his skull, there was a wake given for Finnegan during which whiskey was spilled on the corpse. Finnegan at once sprang back to life. Awake. Yet this resurrection was redoubled in 1939, when after 16 grueling years spent collecting the words and phrases with which he would come into contact, James Joyce finally published his own Finnegan's Wake. Dropping the apostrophe in Finnegan's, perhaps to remove any indication of possession, to pluralize, and to complicate about whom the text is written and for what reason. The text is often considered one of the most difficult pieces of literature in the English language, consisting of neologism, pun, and writing that seems wholly dependent on sound, if not also wholly in its own right. Finnegan's Wake is no simple folktale, yet Joyce provided it this title. He makes the story begin again and never quite makes it fin again. This will be the final example, using yet another one of my favorite collisions between mediums. In 1987, after a rather lengthy career as one of Italy's greatest film directors, Federico Fellini released his Intervista, or Interview in Italian. During the film, Fellini intercut shots of himself working to produce a cinematic rendering of Franz Kafka's story, America, with a K, as so many of Kafka's stories are. Interestingly enough, America had also been titled The Man Who Disappeared, and even The Missing Person. Though an early work, America remained true to some of Kafka's favorite motifs, a protagonist set over and against a mysterious, though powerful system, guilt and innocence, authority, confusion, and the dream. In Intervista, a film that explicitly employs the director himself as actor, it is an interview, or interview. It appears that Fellini also wants his interviewers to consider Kafka and to consider the story of America as they watch Intervista. Given Fellini is Italian, we can push this further. With K, spoken K, or Che voi, what do you want? Recall again the other titles under which the story of America had been inscribed. This arrangement is something reminiscent of 8 1/2. In Intervista, Fellini uses the film, but also these slight, marginal references to Kafka, to K, and to America, to intimate something, to hopefully grab the viewer's attention for a chance encounter. Despite Lacan's rather pointed comment in Seminar 3, The Psychoses, that to use the technique that Freud established outside the experience to which it was applied is as stupid as to toil at the oars when the ship is on sand, I present these vignettes also to intimate, to point to an intersection where culture, or at least the arts, meets the clinic of psychoanalysis. In the end, there is always an intimacy between the two, each endlessly feeding the other. These vignettes are fairly uncommon and tangential references. They are from the rubbish heap, the refuse of observation, to quote Freud from his paper on the Moses of Michelangelo. This is, however, more to their credit than otherwise. They do not show what has been termed merely adaptation, from the text to the screen or myth to story, nor are they examples of derivative mimicry. They are formations of something, creations that are neither ex nihilo, from nothing, nor necessarily a form of deciphering some obscurity. We find in them an indication, a waving of the hand, the raising of a question. what Coltrane, Joyce, and Fellini present are productions that use what has come before for something radically new that does not assume to present the hidden truth of the original. They are produced for certain effects, for impact, for evocation. They are neither completely from within nor without the original work they reference. At once closer and further away, intimately alien, this is to say, uncanny, they are, in essence, metaphors for psychoanalytic interpretation. So what can we make of all this? Well, let's try a little brainwashing on ourselves, to quote Lacan from his seventh seminar. I'm emphasizing the act of interpretation and its effects. I'm doing so intentionally. For, as is often the case when interpretation is approached conceptually, it's approached as a thing, a product. We could or should even say it's disgust. Disgust. Disgustingly disgust. As a commodity, a thing of exchange. You give me that, and I'll give you this. You show me the riddle, and I'll give you its answer. One of the challenges when approaching interpretation and psychoanalysis, and perhaps a reason why, as Lacan noted in his Directions of the Treatment and the Principles of Its Power, that analysts are always embarrassed when they approach it, is that, following Freud, interpretation cannot be defined as a method by which sense is formulated, deliberated upon, and happily handed over to be included in an edifice of insight. It does not, as it were, give Oedipus back his sight. This is precisely the age of interpretation that is behind us, as Jacqueline Miller has noted. Now, it must be recognized that interpretation possesses a different structure that necessitates a different approach. Consider Freud's case studies and his instructions for technique. In the beginning lines of On Beginning the Treatment, Freud compares psychoanalysis to chess, wherein the infinite variety of moves which develop after the opening defy any systematic description. The same can be said of interpretation, given that it has the structure of a contingency, a moment that cannot be predicted ahead of time, nor can it be judged by anything other than its effects on the subject, on desire, and on jouissance. This is the case for a simple yet profound reason. This is how the unconscious speaks in its formations. It is a pulsation, a simultaneous opening and closing through which the unconscious gains expression in the signifier and further through which the drive achieves its substitute satisfaction. We could say that interpretation is of a similar structure as the formations of the unconscious, though its outcomes are the exact reverse. To address interpretation is, therefore, to be in a precarious position, because there is a risk of indexing only everything that it isn't. Some coordinates can be given, some guiding principles, but an interpretation can only be defined après coup, afterwards, or after words. Neither acceptance nor refusal justifies it, because it concerns a different truth. Truth in psychoanalysis is not contingent upon the correspondence to a socially constructed reality. It is also not that which results from calculation. Truth is truth about desire in its singularity. It is not there already waiting to be discovered. It is something constructed at times slowly and at other times instantaneously through the work of analysis. In the end, psychoanalysis is about a subject articulating desire, taking that which is given to them by the other and making it once and for all their own. From mistakes, failure, and the returns of the repressed, interpretation seeks to allow the analysand to speak the truth about desire, no matter how devastating this may be. In speaking of the act of interpretation, I'm attempting to strike upon the point of it being a stylistic representation. A style is what Lacan claimed he was capable of teaching through his return to Freud. Focusing on this point, I'm emphasizing the fact that an interpretation is formed out of the speech of the analysand, the speaking being in analysis, that it takes as its reference the subjective position and division of each individual in their singularity, and that it occurs in a flash. In making an interpretation, a risk is taken, because the act pushes the psychoanalyst to create from within what is or has been there, to open a beyond using only what's at hand. But, to quote Dylan, to live outside the law, you must be honest. The analyst has no guarantee. Every act places one in such a predicament, and to focus on the act involved in interpretation, for which the analyst is completely responsible when it is delivered, is to take us directly to the ethical dimension of psychoanalysis. It is perhaps also the case that this is applicable to every discourse, because to act always already implies ethics. In a paper entitled Lines of Advance in Psychoanalytic Therapy, Freud gave, as a cautionary statement to his readers and to analysts, the following description of such an ethical position. We refused most emphatically to turn a patient who puts himself into our hands in search of help into our private property, to decide his fate for him, to force our own ideals before him, and with the pride of a creator, to form him in our own image and see that it is good. This is, after all, only to use violence, even though it is overlaid with the most honorable motives. To interpret and to act against such comportment is to leave the field of psychoanalysis. The act of interpretation by the analyst aims at invocation and the causing of desire, and who knows what will do so and how it will unfold. Regardless of such a necessary particularity, during his seminar 15, The Psychoanalytic Act, Lacan was quite clear. The position of the analyst is to be an instrument of revelation. It is not to specialize in domestication or a cloistering of understanding. As a psychoanalyst, this is what interests me most. And though I have given the above vignettes, it is also to the clinic that I wish to point, because, again, to quote Lacan, maybe a psychoanalyst is able to make heard something other than meaning. Nearly every day I listen. I listen to stories and dreams, to fantasies and the difficulties of everyday life. I listen to suffering. Because psychoanalysis is predicated upon analysand speaking freely without concern of judgment, it is, arguably, one of the only spaces left in which one is free to do so. I listen to the ways people inscribe their lives in speech through the defiles of the signifier. Each person is welcomed with something of this sentiment. Away you go, say whatever, it will be marvelous. Listening, not seeing, this is important. Yet that to which my listening is directed is not solely the statement. It is not only the verse. It is not merely the narrative story that we, all of us, being human, all too human, wish to point, given that it is so firmly linked to the ego, to identification, which is to say, narcissism. What I'm listening for and what I strive to listen to is precisely the breach in such articulation, the more or less of what is said than is meant, what falls, what fails. The marginalia, the mumblings, the stuttering, the slips, negations, points at which signification breaks down. In the session, I'm listening for equivocation, resonances, and the overdetermination of the signifier. I'm listening to enunciation. Again, from his 11th seminar, Lacan noted the following. Impediment, failure, split. In a spoken or written sentence, something stumbles. There, something other demands to be realized. What is produced in this gap is presented as the discovery, the unconscious as it is in the Freudian field. It is this to which I'm listening. Now, the response to such events is where we can sort things out. Interpretation hinges upon them. Shall they be brushed aside, those slips, the lapses, or should they be taken seriously, to the letter? Should they be made sense of, explained, an X made a Y, or punctuated, brought into further relief, left to stand on their own in order to listen to what they will bring about? To suture or to not or to cut, that's the question. There are many directions, yet you already see a distinction I'm making. Either it is to the coherence of the story, the meaning and understanding that is emphasized or empathized, or is precisely what is said, maybe what isn't, where it may lead, and to what of the subject does it relate. We must acknowledge that for Lacan, as it was for Freud, the subject of the unconscious, the subject that bears and bears desire and that speaks in these ways, is a subject that has no substance. It's no idol. In other words, as Lacan said, it's only that which is represented by one signifier for another. It's an effect of the signifying chain. And further, we could say that the subject is real. No signifier will completely inscribe it. No image will ever capture it. Therefore, if interpretation is an act of the analyst and is directed toward the subject rather than the ego and its resistances, such an act cannot be directed toward the hope of creating an organization, a sense, or a signified. Meaning is imaginary, and the ego just so much of the same. Interpretation is precisely that which cuts through such signification. For what purpose is there for an interpretation to begin with? It is to have effects at the level of the unconscious, and it should therefore occur on the same plane. On numerous occasions, Freud himself described interpretation as art. Moving away from the familiar, colloquial interpretation of Freud, we can focus on its actual practice. An art is, after all, a practice, a way of doing, an act, whatever its content and whatever its product. And if a psychoanalyst is by definition an interpretant, to quote Lacan, this is to say he or she directs the treatment, not the analysand, through such acts as interpretation. It is a matter of ethics that a psychoanalyst work on a different plane than that of making things understood. They are required to work on the plane of desire, at the level of the unconscious and its formations. Interpretations are interventions that operate precisely at these points of subjective division. However, they should close nothing down, hem nothing in. Or maybe it's better to say, they should not close nothing down, not hem nothing in. In his 1975 Yale lectures, Lacan was driving the same idea home by saying, analytic interpretation is not meant to be understood. It's meant to produce waves. Thus, one must not be too obvious in it, and often it's better to remain silent. So we can outline what we've gathered thus far. Interpretation has a structure of an instant, of contingency, of event, to use Alain Badiou. It takes as its reference the actual speech of the analysand. It is an ethical act and an art. It is not in the service of making things understood, and its effects on the unconscious can only define its value and its accuracy. Now, given this, the question is, in what ways does the psychoanalyst interpret? It had been six years, and the majority of her analysis, she had sessions three times a week by request. In this session, she began with a dream. "I'm painting a picture," she mentioned, "and I think that it was some kind of self-portrait, but there was something that wasn't in the picture." "Wasn't in the picture," I noted. "Yes," she continued, "not in the picture." It was relatively clear that she was attempting to describe something about the image of the dream itself, about what was there and what wasn't. Yet, listen again, "wasn't in the picture." "Not in the picture." "It's not in the picture." "It wasn't in the picture," I said in return. Immediately, the equivocation struck her. "Oh, wow, out of the picture. It was out of the picture. I was out of the picture." I ended the session there in hopes of further emphasizing what had been said. During another session, an analysand with whom I've been working for a rather brief time recently said the following. "It was as if I had to cut off that, those feelings." In response, I repeated, "that feeling." I said nothing more and nothing less. Immediately, he proceeded to note that he must not have wanted to say what that feeling was, because after I noted this, he immediately thought of his sexual preferences. Saying those, he reflected, allowed him to avoid that, and when he thought of that feeling and cut off, he drew a link between his sexual fantasies and cutting and violence to blood and to pleasure. After this, he went on to associate to what he had just spoken a number of statements which have repeatedly insisted in his analysis. "I can't cut it, I can't hack it, I can't make the cut." These statements he had made many times and had until that moment merely been ways of talking about inadequacy and failure suddenly took on a different form. In Seminar 17, The Other Side of Psychoanalysis, Lacan develops two important terms for the act of interpretation, citation and enigma. A citation is like this, he says. "I make a statement, and for the remainder, there is a solid support you will find in the author's name for which I hand responsibility back to you. This is how it is, and it has nothing to do with the more or less shaky status of the author's function." The examples just given are formed in such a way. The analysands each said something, and I pointed merely to this fact. However, it was not until the signifiers had been cited and spoken that each analysan recognized, for his or herself, that is, that there was more to be said, more in what was said. Their words had consequences, and they had not heard them until then. I consider these simple enunciations to be interpretations because after each there were effects which took place in both the analysand's discourse as well as in the formations of the unconscious themselves, i.e. dreams and symptoms. In order to decipher the diachrony of unconscious repetitions, Lacan stated in 1958, interpretation must introduce in the synchrony of signifiers that come together there something that suddenly makes translation possible. Simple signifiers, repeated back with different emphases, led to unwinding, rewriting, and loosening. They initiated an entirely new discourse that retroactively changed the previously established sense of things. For Lacan, returning to Seminar 17, enigma is something different. An enigma is an utterance, in his definition. It is an utterance that does not immediately produce a message because it is not a statement. It's a signifier with no signified, a signifier left alone. There are a number of examples of enigma, oracular statements, which Michael alluded to, half-sayings, drawn-out enunciations, emphases given, repetitions of single words and sounds, rearranging of statements, and punctuations. These are merely a few. There was a moment in my own analysis I will use as an example. I was about 4 years in, and I was discussing a dream. During my articulation of the dream text, I used the signifier criticize, and my analyst said immediately, "Whose eyes?" I was taken aback, and my first association was to a paragraph on the first page of Joyce's Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man. Pull out his eyes, apologize, apologize, pull out his eyes, apologize, pull out his eyes, pull out his eyes, apologize. It goes without saying my session ended there. Yet, from that moment, I began to experience a great deal of anguish, and my analysis was never the same. This interpretation affected me greatly, because though it did not deliver any sense, it struck upon something. In L'Étourdie, a text from 1972, Lacan outlined 3 points at which the psychoanalyst has the duty to interpret. First, at the level of the signifier and homophony. Second, at the level of grammar. And finally, at the level of logic. Why here, we might ask? Because it's possible to hear a lapsus in each, the pulsation of the unconscious, and if the analyst interprets at any one of these points, it's possible for the analysand to encounter something that had until that moment remained unsaid, been unspeakable, or unnameable, to invoke Beckett as is good practice. This is, after all, what's at stake, to move from a saying to a saying. Recently, a rather frustrated and exhausted analysand abruptly stopped what he was saying and asked, "Do you have any thoughts about all this?" In response, I said back, "About all this." But I sped up the tempo, not wanting it to be a citation in this case, and I repeated it a few times, "About all this, about all this, about all this." The analysand was admittedly confused, and he asked for clarification, "About oldness?" And from there, he began to discuss his fear of growing old, death, and the serious potential of loneliness for the rest of his life. About all this and about oldness were linked together phonetically at the level of homophony, and in so being, they have since led this analysand to interrogate the anguish of his old age. From this moment, this individual has been able to avoid his penchant for obfuscation and direct himself toward acting from his desire. While discussing a situation in which he experienced a great deal of anguish, fear, and rage, and referencing the people with whom he was interacting at the time, an analysand stated, "You guys are all being really threatening to me." Since in the discussion, the analysand had moved from using they to you, an equivocation was introduced regarding the object of the statement. And since it was spoken to me as the one who was listening, it was possible that I was also being implicated. "You" allows for this grammatically. And upon recognizing this aloud, saying, "Who, me?" The analysand began to speak about how he does feel this way about me, but had until that point not wanted to say anything about it. a final example, and one related to logic. In Lettre D, Lacan seems to mean by logic internal coherence, not correspondence. We must keep this in mind because the analyst, in his or her position and interpretation at the level of logic, must not take the position of an authority, a teacher, or a master, as is always the case. Logic applies to the internal coherence of the analysand's speech. Again, from an ongoing analysis. She began her analysis preceding a number of events which proved uncharacteristically disappointing. Through her articulation of them, a problematic impasse began to emerge that was a part of each. It had been her understanding that to succeed in life, in love and work, a certain formula had to be followed, good Lord, or an ideal format adhered to. Yet each time she attempted to accomplish this, she would do something, though she was often unsure exactly what, that would initiate a rapid collapse and an irreparable failure of her current pursuits. During a session, she mentioned multiple times her wish that others would accept her. Yet at the same time, during the same session, she talked about her feelings that this happened with everyone except her. After making an interpretation at the level of homophony between the two terms, she responded by noting that she always wanted to be accepted. She also wanted to be the exception, to be exceptional. The logical impasse between the two terms was clear, and she noted that in some of the situations which caused so much disappointment for her, her partnerships, as well as her work experience, the inevitable end was brought about by the very difference in these signifiers, attempting to be accepted and trying to be the exception. Accept me and accept me. To conclude, I would like to return to the question of fate, the fates of interpretation. In the title of this panel, we wondered about this specifically, and by doing so, made a subtle allusion to Freud's paper, The Drive and Their Fates, more commonly known as Instincts and Their Vicissitudes. In raising this question of fates, we can play off the title of another Joyce, Joyce Carol Oates, and ask, where are we going given where we have been? In what I presented here, following Freud and Lacan, I'm alluding to, perhaps also eluding, an answer. In Seminar 24, Love is the Failure of the Unconscious, a title that when written in French requires truly acrobatic reading, Lacan says the following. Meaning acts as a blotter, but with the help of what they call poetic writing, you can get to the dimension of what analytic interpretation might be. This is followed by a very important question. Can the psychoanalyst possibly be inspired to make interventions as a psychoanalyst by something on the order of poetry? Poetics, then, and the order of poetry may open a new way of outlining the contours of the act of interpretation. Maybe each of us, whether psychoanalyst or otherwise, may begin to act through the impasse created between being a poet of the not enough and being enough of a not poet. At least this is what Lacan saw as the opportunity before us and specifically for interpretation and psychoanalysis. Thanks.
All right, thanks. I'm gonna start the third paper here. My name is Stuart Nafziger. I'm a resident in counseling at JMU's Counseling Center. And my paper is titled On Interpretation and Being Hungry. And in my paper, I use the novel The Elegance of the Hedgehog as kind of a conversation partner for talking about interpretation. And if you don't know anything about The Elegance of the Hedgehog, it's about an apartment complex and the folks living in it in France. The novel focuses on two main characters. One is the concierge or caretaker of the apartment complex, and her name is Renee. And the other main character is Paloma, who's a 12-year-old little girl who plans to commit suicide. And the book follows her leanings toward and away from committing suicide on her 13th birthday. In the book, there's also a third character who joins about midway through, and he's a Japanese businessman. And my paper talks about interpretation and also how this businessman serves a role in interpretation. So the epigraph to my paper is a quote by Paloma, the 12-year-old little girl, and she says, "But many intelligent people have a sort of bug. They think intelligence is an end in itself. They can have one idea in mind to be intelligent, which is really stupid." And I also begin with a quote. "Say hello to your mother," I murmur as I close the door in his face, hoping that the complete dissonance between my two sentences will be veiled by the might of millennial prejudice. End quote. Whatever two sentences were spoken, noticing dissonance between them is a way of both interpreting and listening for others' interpretations of themselves. And instructing someone to say hello to one's mother may be a quip example of how professionals both inside and out have interpreted and interpret in psychoanalysis. Interpretation in psychoanalysis, for this reason and perhaps others, has gotten a bad rap in the therapeutic community. Psychoanalysis was, at one time, and may unfortunately continue to be, for many of us, another way of talking about how to greet others' free speech by closing a door in their face. Too often, perhaps, the language of psychoanalysis has been used to close doors on its speakers' faces, veiling its dissonance through complexity. And this, as many are quick to point out, is not a form of greeting at all. Still, is it a possibility that much of one's psychoanalysis may not be about the mother one chooses not to or is unable to speak to? For the character Renee in Marielle Barbary's book, The Elegance of the Hedgehog, her instruction read at the beginning of the last paragraph may be understood ironically, because it had more to do with her own distaste toward blanket statements about mothers, and less to do with Antoine Palier or his mother, whom she addressed. Renee's statement is another way of hiding something about herself and something about her mother. As the reader gets further in the book, she or he learns about Renee's reaction to another statement about mothers that her deceased husband, Lucien, once said. Quote, "A mother who loves her children always knows when they are in trouble." Renee says, quote, "Personally, I do not care much for this interpretation, because there is nothing of a mother's love in my mother's intuition, merely the translation into gesture of her certainty of misfortune." In this quote, Renee is sharing with us something about the distinction between theory and reality, and exposing our perhaps unconscious belief that they are the same thing. Interpretation is what is left of belief after it has encountered reality. It is one of the ways we articulate what we are missing from reality. Interpretation is retroactive, but it is also the thing that we as clinicians in the helping fields tend to hear first from our clients. It may be one of the surest and securest ways we have of talking about ourselves. Put another way, interpretation is a way of testing that we have or do not have a self in relation to other people. It may be a form of self-doing or undoing. As professionals, we are faced with the question of how to listen to our clients' interpretations in such a way that does not yet again reinterpret them before we've heard what they have to say, which is another way of guarding against the imperialism of clinical theory. Maybe not all of analysis needs to begin with the injunction, "Say hello to your mother." In this essay, I would like to recognize how discussing interpretation may be a practice of the technique in and of itself. Following in the tradition of psychoanalysis, I'll discuss it through story and the fragments we create in the making of one. The story of The Elegance of the Hedgehog, like the story of the tradition of psychoanalysis and the characters in it, has many fragments worth listening to. The book is useful for distinguishing the kind of knowledge a clinician uses to interpret, and how a clinician might go about interpreting. Like the epigraph stated, intelligence for intelligence's sake is stupidity. The French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan had his own unique way of interpreting in psychoanalysis, and maybe a fragment considered worth listening to. In the French language, there are two different ways of understanding knowledge, connaissance and savoir. The first form of knowledge is easy to speak about and hard to practice, while the second is exactly the opposite. Through connaissance, one is reminded knowing about psychoanalysis does not help one do it. Savoir is a particular kind of skill developed through the analyst's appetite, his or her hunger for analysis. This is what Lacan termed the desire of the analyst. Talking about savoir is a way of discussing the analyst's hunger to question identity, behavior, and his or her response based on a particular style of listening. In this way, a psychoanalyst's savoir could change the analysand's larger story or challenge him or her to use a different metaphor in order to speak about life. Although not every analysis needs to begin with, say hello to your mother, Renee's comment reminds us of experiences where we have said much more than we have meant, and how much we have to, and how much we feel we have to lose with others when this happens. The dissonance between her sentences at once has to do with how she interprets herself and how she fears others will interpret her. Her fears are both political and personal, a struggle between class structure and maintaining composure. When a concierge references the German ideology written by Marx, as René did in this scene, others, and in this case the character Antoine Palier, will notice and reinterpret her. In a French Cartesian society, concierges need to speak like concierges, not aristocrats. Much of the elegance of the hedgehog is about the allure as well as the pressure we feel as individuals to obtain and maintain the composure of a single-story interpretation of ourselves. The pressure society can put on us to speak of our identity instead of identities and the consequences of doing so. Like many of us, Renee feels she must operate with the assumption of having only one identity instead of experiencing various versions of herself across different characters. However, all of her does not fit the image and symbolic identity of a concierge, so she continually censors her speech in order to fit this identity. It is only through her slips that she exposes her intelligence and love of literature to others. She conceals the excess of her identity by speaking as a concierge, not a well-read aristocrat. Throughout the book, Renee has the opportunity to become more than her single-story identity, more than a token of the lower class. The reader, like the clinician, is then able to see how identity becomes something that becomes more of a continual process, something we are constantly doing and undoing with other people, intentionally and unintentionally, as well as how interpretation is always, at least in part, so long as it is based on speech, a political activity. If identity is something we do and undo with other people, then how we listen to them have real implications for who we interpret them to be. When Renee slips by quoting part of the first line of Anna Karenina by Tolstoy, "All happy families are alike," and Monsieur Atsu, the Japanese businessman that I mentioned, responds to her by finishing the quote, "Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way," he is undoing her identity as a concierge. He is responding to her not just as a concierge, but as someone who loves literature. And Renee can no longer be just a concierge in a French Cartesian society. Monsieur Atsu comes to this realization as he is speaking to Paloma, a 12-year-old little girl. He says, quote, "I suspect that she's, Renee's, not what we think." Monsieur Atsu is interesting because he is also not what or who others think. In undoing Renee's identity, his has also been undone. Paloma, in response to Monsieur Atsu, reveals, quote, "I've had my own suspicions on that matter for a while now, too. From a distance, she's a real concierge. Close up, there's something weird going on." Monsieur Atsu is not afraid to get close, and he is not afraid when people turn out to be different than who they appear to be from far away. And adults, like Monsieur Atsu, are also not afraid to talk to children. When adults respect children like adults, it is a good sign they are not afraid to be spoken to as children. If children are a metaphor for being close, it is not surprising many clinical theories like to keep people far away. We have real symbolic identities when we are far away from each other. A concierge is just a concierge, a client suffering from depression just as depression. Up close, as we so often discover, there's something weird going on. Paloma spends much of the book trying to rework the possibility of her life beyond her 13th birthday, on which she plans to kill herself. Suicide, the most daunting and definitive ending of a single-story interpretation, is another way of stating exactly who one thinks one is in relation to other people. and this form of knowledge can seem to promise someone enough ill satisfaction to make this way of interpreting one's life alluring. Words become the way Paloma works through this interpretation. In these journals, she does this through two journals, one based on beauty and the other on profound thoughts. In these journals, she struggles to find a language for the events that go on around her, to actively re-describe her world against the interpretation that her life is not worth living. The technique of interpretation has something to do with the affecting power of language that language has on our bodies and the ways in which we experience the world through it, both in our suffering and celebration. Being able to speak about one's experience can make life both worth living and not worth living for. It is important to question what kind of listening makes speaking about life worth living it. In the standard edition to the complete works of Sigmund Freud, the word interpretation appears 1,012 times, emphasizing how fundamental and under question this word is to the practice of Freudian psychoanalysis, how suspect it is to its own definitions. Even psychotherapy proper, if there is such a thing, hinges on the unsettling quality language has on the body and the extremely powerful affect that comes of the body when speaking rightly. Perhaps one of the difficulties of interpretation in psychoanalysis is that it's not done in order to settle our experience of speaking. Lacan's concept of savoir is used in interpretation to continue the process of analysis, to open the analysis up to the experience of what he calls speaking well. In Freud's paper on negation, he discussed free association and analysis as a way of feeling out what one is saying. Feeling out is an active sort of perception we do using and being used by our words, the same way we do with our senses. This way of speaking shows us we do not know the value of our words before we speak them. And according to Freud, we are always feeling out and speaking definitively, doing and undoing, literally speaking ambivalence. Only through the continued presentation of unconscious material, i.e. slips, dreams, repetitive actions, etc., can interpretations be evaluated, not by our response to them. Interpretations create interpretations, and the unconscious is inexhaustible. This is because it's something that is structured like a language. It is overdetermined and associative, as Lacan might have said. We are speaking beings that always have more to say. However, saying more may also disrupt what we've already said, and sometimes we say things just to feel out what it was like for words to become unsettled. When Paloma shares with the reader her intent to commit suicide on page 25, as well as her commitment to her two journals, she is doing her best to go on speaking, to judge the value of her words after they are written. As Freud might have said about Paloma had he been addressing her in an outline of psychoanalysis, she is making suppositions about what happened to her and what she has forgotten, as well as what is currently happening inside her, without her understanding. Making suppositions on what happened and is happening is a way of working through an emotional state. And doing this through journaling is a good way to avoid the judgment of parents and other authority figures. Journaling gives her the opportunity to test out how she really feels. In the beginning of the book, she has settled on killing herself, as well as writing in her two journals, and her decision is very unsettling for her to go about the doing of it. Doing is also a process of undoing, when settling is unsettling. In the first sentence of the entry on interpretation in Dylan Evans' An Introductory Dictionary to Lacanian Psychoanalysis, he writes, quote, "The role of the analyst in the treatment is twofold. First and foremost, he must listen to the analysand, but must also intervene by speaking to the analysand. The analyst's first job is to listen to the speech of the analysand free associating. Just like perception is not passive in psychoanalysis, listening must not be for either person involved. Like Monsieur Atsu and Renee experienced, listening brings others close in a way that makes them something other than who they were when they were far away. Psychoanalysts are people who listen without the pressure of responding, and somehow, through relieving themselves of this pressure, are also able to hear things that other people do not. They are not captured by conversation because of connection, but instead because of the equivocation of speech. They follow Lacan's rule of, the less you understand, the better you listen. And the better you listen, the closer people become. Analysts are not are those who fundamentally believe there is sense in our nonsense, the sense that unconsciously bungles our actions and misplaces our speech. Taking Lacan seriously means that it is better for the analyst to not succumb to the illusion of understanding the analysand via theory in order to keep on believing in the treatment and thus fulfilling the primary role of listening. It's important to understand that the analyst must listen before being able to respond, and that she or he cannot respond in the exactly the same way any other time before that after having listened. The suspension of understanding has more to do with resisting the urge to prematurely interpret a clinical moment than it does flagrant clinical work. In this sense, the treatment via free association continually undermines psychoanalytic theory, even though some analysts have been keen to hide this dimension of psychotherapy. So, when considering the topic of interpretation, we need to consider what it might be like to not know what one is going to hear before it's heard, to not be listening for specific content as designated by the clinician's theory, but instead to listen for how it's said. We also need to consider what it might be like to keep listening to others despite how close they become, no matter how weird it gets. If the analyst's primary job is to listen, and if actions speak louder than words, then we also need to learn how to listen when it is the body that speaks through acting out. We must note that the mouth is more closely related to the body than the so-called mind, and that the mouth is not the only part of the body which uses and is used by language. Maybe Freud meant this when he said, quote, "We acquire the material of our work from various sources, from whatever the patient's communications and free associations allude to, and from whatever he demonstrates, acts out in his transferences." The analyst must also first listen before responding to behavior. Lacan also had important things to say and act out against and for the rest of the psychoanalytic community. Like any other form of acting out, when actions are speaking louder than words, the message has often already been interpreted and waiting to be listened to. Lacan was excommunicated from the International Psychoanalytic Association, the IPA, because his technique of the variable length session subverted the standard 50-minute session in the psychoanalytic community. Perhaps Lacan's message, that time in session is also technique, was better not outrightly verbalized, as his form of psychoanalysis was more about punctuating its process than verbalizing it. In a time when actions were less worthy than words, but often said more, Lacan may be thought of as another person who also encouraged others to relieve themselves of the pressure of understanding a message before listening to it. Sometimes acting out is the only viable form of speaking. It's important to interpret Lacan's behavior as acting out against the IPA and not as a symptom. A symptom is a bungled form of enjoyment, one that is unconscious and perhaps attention-getting, but does not involve the other in its functioning. Acting out, however, according to Lacan, is another way of speaking within the dynamic of the transference, which he terms as a call to the other. And when Lacan is talking about what is other, or the big other, or the other, he is talking about parents, language, and other autonomous forces we feel we need more than they need us. Acting out is an attempt to make a statement about this inequality. Lacan acted out the importance of how important acting out may be in psychoanalysis, and this was a direct call to the other that was the establishment of psychoanalysis at the time. Unlike the IPA, Lacan did not think that it was the client who needed to speak more appropriately, but for the therapist to learn how to listen differently. Lacan viewed acting out as that which, in analysis, demands interpretation. The Elegance of the Hedgehog had something to say about acting out and sending a message to authority figures. And we must remember that all messages that protest and cry for help have their beginnings in the context of the family. Paloma tells us, quote, "If you want to reinforce your psychoanalyst's belief in his own mastery, provoke him the way kids provoke their parents." At this point in the book, Paloma has already provoked her mother by acting out, by speaking through action and concealing her message in a journal. She does the same with the psychoanalyst. Like a teenager provoking an adult, Paloma disengages and frustrates him. She had already heard him explain too much to know that he would listen to her. She knows that understanding is similar to selective hearing, and that psychoanalytic theory can make analysts feel like they are quick to understanding. In order to complete her journal, she needed to find a setting that would lend itself to her writing. She achieves this by hiding from her family, which may be interpreted as acting out. Her actions spoke louder than her words to her mother, or to put it another way, she distracted her mother by speaking her actions instead of enacting the words she was writing. The words she had settled on writing about committing or not committing suicide were very unsettling, and at this point in her journals, she had not felt either option was convincing. Hiding was both a way of acting out what it might be like to disappear, an opportunity to feel out the words that were both worth and not worth living for, as well as a way for her to address her mother and behavior. You make me want to disappear. Neither her mother nor the psychoanalyst provided the interpretation demanded by her behavior. The movement that became Lacan's version of psychoanalysis demanded a similar interpretive shift from explanation and knowledge to listening and punctuating, on which this quote from Freud's Constructions in Analysis may be commenting. He writes, quote, "If you hear very little about constructions in analytical technique, that is because we talk instead about interpretations and their effect. A construction is a clinical speculation, a fancy word for explanation. Interpretations are something else entirely, and they bring with them specific effects. Interpretations are something much closer to what other psychotherapists may refer to as reflections and other interventions. They punctuate, highlight, and texture fragments of the conversation. There is something else about an interpretation that does not come with a construction, which is more effective, something to do with appetite. Quote, for those who have no appetite, the first pangs of hunger are both a source of suffering and illumination, says Renee about one of her earliest experiences of interpretation. Renee shares this memory as a way of reflecting on how her reading teacher opened her to a new world of experience, as well as how that world became forbidden for her when she was forced to leave school at the age of 12. Before interacting with her teacher, Renee was a perfectly operational machine. Quote, her teacher both introduced and interpreted Renee, prizing her as a child. Renee says, in order for consciousness to be aroused, it must have a name. At the moment Renee became aroused, she had also been forbidden. She concealed her love of reading from the other students. She says, I was careful to conceal the pleasure and interest that reading afforded me. Renee was not a girl who was supposed to know how to read before her peers, not one who was supposed to take pleasure in her studies. Just by being addressed by her teacher, just by saying her name, by prizing and listening to her in the classroom, quote, the feeble child became a hungry soul. When Renee is named as something other than what she has known herself to be, which was, quote, a perfectly operational machine, she was instilled with something that gave her an appetite. She became a hungry soul. And if we follow Freud in considering clinical material to be as important as and determinative of theory, then we must question what interpretation has to do with becoming a hungry soul. Does interpretation feed a hungry soul? And what might a soul be hungry for? A relationship, coping strategies, or perhaps some other kind of spiritual offering? Like Freud did much of the time, he thought being hungry had something to do with sexuality. In his three essays on sexual theory, he said, quote, when biologists discuss the sexual needs of men and animals, they assume the existence of a sexual drive. Following the analogy of the drive to seek food, hunger. For this purpose, science uses the word libido. In this quote, Lacan would have read Freud as both interpreting himself as a scientist, but also distinguishing between physical need and drive. Drive and need are incompatible, and human sexuality is not like any other forms of animal sexuality. A drive is not satisfied by the objects it finds. As Freud demonstrates through his hunger to be a scientist, working to satisfy an appetite of any kind is an interpretation in itself. Perhaps one question which may be important in this discussion is not what to do with a hungry soul, but what about experiencing life as one makes life worth living? And how can we listen to others in a way that makes their souls hungry? In a sense, The Elegance of the Hedgehog is about the lived experiment of being a hungry soul, and what being hungry might also mean about being human. As with appetite, we can talk about being hungry for just about anything. Hunger can both be a source of suffering and excitement, and there is a sense in which satisfaction is only a short-term treatment for our appetites. There is no long-term concept of satisfaction when it comes to hunger or an appetite, except maybe death. We always need more, and more is never enough. Too much is painful in the way that too little is impossible to bear. Renée is caught between too much and too little, isolated by her hunger and satisfactions. She hungers for something more than what she is able to eat and worries about the consequences. She is caught between the anxiety of expressing her hunger for literature, philosophy, and psychoanalysis with Monsieur Atsu, and the depressed position of its inhibition. Renée said, "It became clear to me that my path had to be one of secrecy." Her single story interpretation of her hunger is her short-term treatment, her twisted symptom of satisfaction. And by concealing her hunger, by suppressing it, she becomes her own casualty. When speaking in terms of appetite or hunger, I find it funny that the question of why is off the table, so to speak. When at the table, we don't question why someone is hungry. Hunger is a predisposition for being there. Freud and Lacan thought our appetites and the myriad of ways in which we are hungry for life and death was a predisposition for being human. We are creatures in need of others, and we become hungry for others in the ways in which they fall short of satisfying our demands. This is another way of saying that others help us through life, and our desire is all we can do to repay them. If this is a helpful way of thinking, talking, and of course listening to people who are hungry, we need to question if this is the kind of person Renée was in The Elegance of the Hedgehog. If Renée is this kind of person, we know that she became a hungry soul when she also became conscious, and that her conscious history is also a history of appetite and starvation. She starves herself, in a sense, because her appetite threatens to destroy her symbolic identity, and she threatens to destroy herself through starvation. How and what we are fed, and what others we consider to be like us are fed, become the way we begin to talk about how and why we experience hunger. We are fed temporary sense and satisfaction in relation to our hunger, and that becomes the only way that we know how to talk about being hungry. The reader, late in the book, when Renée is contemplating joining Monsieur Atsu for dinner, is exposed to the possible reasons why she conceals her appetite and willingly starves herself. Renée views her sister as unjustly destroyed by her appetite when she dies in childbirth. Renée's sister's death has both political and personal consequences. Renée feels she is always more hungry than she could possibly eat, and interprets the tragedy as political predestination. Renée says, "From this, I derive two certainties. The strong live and the weak die, and their pleasure and suffering are proportionate to their position in the hierarchy." Lisette, Renée's sister, had been beautiful and poor. I was intelligent and indignant, but like her, I was doomed to a similar punishment if I ever sought to make good use of my mind in defiance of my class. Talking about how we are hungry is a way of making sense of and sometimes trying to extinguish our appetite, either through starvation or overeating. The way that a psychoanalyst listens to an analysan does not make sense making the point of talking. The point is not to extinguish our appetites, our hunger. Instead, this is a given, a predisposition for treatment. Free associating is not done in order to experience our hunger, in order to settle our experience of hunger. It shows us how our concept of hunger is a symptom of the way we have been fed and wish to be fed. And like with most symptoms, they are compromises of satisfaction, casualties of feeling full or starved. They make us unable to enjoy eating. In Freud and Lacan's version of appetites, no appetite is like any other. No analysan has been helped and has identified, construed their story with others in exactly the same way. And like the psychoanalyst listens, an appetite is a specific hunger for the other. So when Monsieur Atsu says to Renee, sitting across from her, eating sushi and celebrating his birthday, "You are not your sister. We can be anything we want to be." He was not just redescribing the possibility of their relationship to each other, but also the history of her appetite. His statement is both political and personal, as a wealthy apartment owner to a concierge. He gave her the possibility of experiencing her hunger toward others in her past and present in a completely different way. Renee cries as Monsieur Atsu interprets her, quite possibly because she has much more in her life for which she hungers. I want to suggest that Monsieur Atsu's interpretation was an example of elegance in the book. In the Oxford English Dictionary, one definition of elegance is relevant to our discussion on interpretation: simple beauty. Monsieur Atsu's interactions highlighted both Renee's political and personal struggle, reinterpreting her single-story view of herself into a hunger for more. When Monsieur Atsu finishes Renee's quote from Anna Karenina, when he sends her a book because her cat is named Leo, referencing Tolstoy, he is illustrating the simple beauty of interpretation. He is reinterpreting her appetite in a way that did not need to be extinguished through excess or starvation. His words fed her, offering her a taste of what it might be like to be hungry. His interpretations, like Freud and Lacan's use of the technique, was not an attempt to explain anything to her, but to break down her form of understanding. It worked in reverse, dissolving the divisions that were created through her language associations and the French Cartesian social class. In a moment of elegance, his interpretation did not tell her what to do or how to relate to others, only that it was still up for discussion. Much of Renee's dialogue throughout the book is about convincing the reader her identity and life are not worth discussing. Through Monsieur Atsu's interpretations, he indicated that he was listening to her psychoanalytically, and as a result, Renee started to consider who or what else she might be, a friend, lover of literature. All of this was done by freeing her hunger for something beyond her established patterns of extinguishing it. He reminded her she was something other than who she knew herself to be, and she became a hungry soul. In the book, The Elegance of the Hedgehog, hunger and appetite is somewhat of a cautionary tale. Like many of us and our clients, the two primary characters in the book, Renee and Paloma, are masters of extinguishing their hunger for life in service of their modern and understandable lives, experiencing anxiety, depression, and the threat of suicide as a result. When Renee leaves her dinner with Monsieur Atsu, she views other characters in the book differently. The wealthy apartment owners, although ignorant, are no longer malicious, just ignorant. However, when Renee approaches to help another character in the street, she is struck by a delivery truck and dies. The reader is exposed to the repetition Renee feared, and she shares the same fate as her sister. Still, death is not all anguish, as Muriel Barbery uses Renee's death as a final reinterpretation of her character. Renee, in her dying moments, has the opportunity to articulate how much she cares for Paloma. And Paloma, in turn, interprets Renee's death by writing in her journal. Maybe that's what life is all about. There's a lot of despair, but also the odd moment of beauty, where time is no longer the same. It's as if those strains of music created are a sort of interlude in time, something suspended and elsewhere that had to come to us, and always within never. Yes, that's it, and always within never. From this moment, Paloma's perspective is reinterpreted. Renee's death has exposed and interpreted what her acting out demanded. There was an elegant interpretation to be made of Renee's death, and it saved Paloma's life. Like Paloma, the clinician may also be spurred by the interpretation of death. After Freud and Lacan, clinicians still need to make something of their interpretations, searching for those moments which are an always within never. To think about this kind of elegant interpretation, we also need to consider what motivates analysis: desire. As Adam Phillips said, an object of desire is a map and not the ground. And it's all about keeping ourselves hungry and unharmed. desire is less about finding the thing itself and more about the searching, less about satisfaction and more about hunger. And in Lacan's conception of desire within the transference, the analyst has a map of his own. He or she is also hungry. The analyst is not hungry, however, in the same way that the analysand is hungry, but is hungry for the analysand to be hungry, for the process of analysis to continue. This is achieved through their formation as analysts by becoming hungry through their own training analysis. The desire of the analyst is Lacan's way of prizing hunger over satisfaction within the conversation of transference and countertransference. And this is a hunger that is spurred by something more than knowledge about the analysis. It is spurred by also becoming a hungry soul. And always within never, then, is essentially about igniting the hunger in our satisfactions. So if the analyst is a map, a way of initiating hunger in others, how does this change our view of the so-called mental health clinician? I am curious about how we set requirements for being something so singular. What are the requirements for developing savoir? And this, perhaps, exposes the necessary myth of the standardization of treatment. Everyone is hungry and we need to help them be hungry, but we cannot treat or even interpret everyone in the same way. Analysts may be one of the few types of people in our culture today who do not feed us in the ways we are hungry. They do not give us our desire because our identifications do not stick to them. At best, perhaps, they are mirrors that are not reflective, but instead make us question the image we thought we were going to see. They are the ones who are up close and notice the weird things going on. And if this is what a mental health clinician is going to be, then it may have real implications for what we consider to be treatment. The treatment psychoanalysis no longer fits the medical model. It is still a model of deficiency, but not one in which we know exactly how others are deficient. We know they are hungry and perhaps how they may want to be fed, but feeding them does not help them renegotiate their relationship to their hunger. We do not know what to say until we've listened, and we cannot listen until we relieve ourselves of the pressure of saying something. We know that clients have created their single story identities via those around them and social structure, but knowing this does not help us interpret their problems. In fact, it may be part of the problem. This may be because stories are too easily construed from fragments and fragments too easily concealed from stories. And so the therapist is always listening for something more than what is being said through a slip, dream, or through the unconscious act. Psychoanalysis is a discipline aimed at revealing what has been concealed and who itself has a history of concealing. Its history ironizes its own form of treatment and concept of interpretation and concept of interpretation, because psychoanalysis, like the characters in it and the book The Elegance of the Hedgehog, is too much for its own symbolic identity. And like Rene was told by Monsieur Atsu over sushi, psychoanalysis somewhere along the line seems to have been offered the interpretation, you can be anything you want to be, and it did. Thanks.
Thank you, Stuart, and thank you, Nate.
And many thanks to all of you for being here tonight.